Well, we're now in the long season after Trinity, and if there is a sort of theme to those weeks after Trinity, it's about what it means to be a Christian, how to live the Christian life. And so there are readings from Acts and from the Gospels in particular. And in Bible times, if your name was either Herod or James or Mary, then you could very easily be mistaken for somebody else. You might have noticed there are a lot of people with those names in the Bible. Have a look at our first reading from Acts 12, if you would. It starts with King Herod. Now, not a lot of people know this, but there are 8 Herods in the New Testament, starting with Herod the Great. He's the one who received the wise men in Jerusalem, and who killed all the baby boys in Bethlehem about the time when Jesus was born. But this Herod here is his grandson, Herod Agrippa I. This one was born around 10 BC, and he ruled as puppet king of Judea from 41 to 44 AD. So you know pretty accurately when all of this happened. And verse 2 records the death of James. Which James? James the Apostle, also known as James the Great. And he's the one, if you've ever been to Santiago de Compostela in the north of Spain, he's the one who's celebrated in that city, commemorated. Brother of John. You remember in the Gospels they talk about James and John, don't they? Boanerges, the sons of thunder. Sons of Zebedee, name of their father. And this is the James who was put to death by Herod in our reading. There was also another apostle called James, the son of Alphaeus, also known as James the Less. And then there was also James, the brother of Jesus. He wasn't an apostle at all, but he, after this James is killed, James, the brother of Jesus, pops up in Jerusalem and is leading the church in Acts 15 when they have the debate about whether they should ask the Gentiles to become Jews or not. So that's James the Just, he's sometimes called, and he's the one who wrote the letter of James in the New Testament. There you go. Now you're thoroughly confused, aren't you? There are 6 or 7 Marys as well, because in Jesus' day, around about 1 in 5 girls was called Mary. So you can imagine in class at school, you'd have a lot of difficulty separating all the Marys. Anyway, it's a puzzle, isn't it? But James here, James the Apostle, has been killed by Herod. And Herod's worked out that actually that was a good move. He's done a good thing. He's really put the church on the back foot. And so he arrests Peter, and it's not looking good for Peter at all. No wonder in verse 5 we hear the church was earnestly praying to God for him. I wonder if you can think of examples of that, where people are in real danger of their lives, and so the church gets praying for them. Maybe you know people who are out in Iraq. Do you remember Ray Scantlebury, who was on the Two Rivers Mission team, the TFM team, who was here? Well, pretty soon after he left us here, Ray went out to Iraq, to northern Iraq, to work amongst the people there and to tell them about Jesus. We trust he's well, but we've been praying for him in the weeks since he went out. And indeed, Canon Andrew White, the vicar of Baghdad, is out there at the moment in the middle of all the struggles and the fighting that are going on. When people are in danger, we pray for them, don't we? No wonder the church was praying. Notice, by the way, buildings can't pray. When it says the church was praying, it means the people, the family of God. And isn't it good if you're in trouble, if you're in need, to know that you belong to a church who will pray for you and support you? That's part of the reason why our network groups, our home groups,
are so helpful to people because they offer support and prayer for your particular needs. But Peter is sleeping halfway down the left-hand page there. The night before, he was on trial for his life. He's sleeping soundly between two soldiers. How amazing is that? Sleeping the sleep of the just. Maybe that was God blessing him with sleep. We read in the Psalms, the Lord gives to his beloved in sleep. Maybe the church was praying that he'd have a good night's sleep. So he's fast asleep, he's deep in sleep, and he's woken by a dig in the ribs. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but you wake up a little bit confused and dazed, don't you? You're really not entirely sure if you're still asleep and dreaming or whether you're awake and something's happening. In verse 9, he thinks he's still dreaming. He thought he was seeing a vision. He had no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He's still almost sleepwalking, dozy. But later on, towards the bottom, Peter came to himself and said, "Now I know that the Lord has sent his angel." Now you might think he'd remember because he was released from prison once before by an angel in Acts chapter 5, verse 19. Something very similar happened. Peter was released from prison. And when God acts, this is what I want you to notice. When God acts like this, it doesn't seem like fireworks and the sky lighting up and everything. It seems very natural and very easy. Peter thought that it was no big deal, really. The angel woke him, and it seemed as if the guards were fast asleep. He didn't know why. It seemed as if the chains that were binding his hands just fell off his wrists. It seemed as if the doors just swung open of their own accord. It didn't seem difficult. He didn't have to pray like stink. God just did it, and it seemed natural and easy. And that's really a theme that I want us to notice through this morning. I want us to think of what it's like when God acts. Naturally supernatural. It just seems like normal life, as if we knew he'd do that anyway. It's no big deal. The second reading that Joe read to us also features Peter, Peter's confession of Jesus. And in fact, in all the Gospels, when you get to this event, when Peter says, "You are the Christ," it's almost like a hinge in the Gospel. It's as if the whole story sort of turns. The first half of the Gospel is about Jesus introducing the kingdom of God, telling people the good news that the kingdom is right here. It's coming right now. But then the moment Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," it's as if it turns darker. Jesus turns towards Jerusalem and towards his death on the cross. And he asks this key question, "Who do you say I am?" Well, in fact, he doesn't start like that. He starts with a little vox pop. What do other people say? And then he makes it personal. What do you say? There's a clue in the little phrase, "I am," isn't there? That was the name that God told Moses, the name that God gave to Moses as his name. And Simon Peter nails it in one. "You're the Christ. You're the Son of the living God." Again, when you're in the zone, the answers come easily, don't they? It seems natural. Peter just knew it. He knew who Jesus was. Don't overthink it. Go with your gut. And Jesus gives him top marks. "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because no man told you this, You didn't learn this in school. You didn't sit at the feet of a rabbi to learn this. You learnt it from God the Father in heaven. You've got it, said Jesus. You've hit the jackpot. Now, I don't expect Peter was aware that God had told him this. He just knew it. He just knew it was true. And that's how it is when God speaks to you. Maybe the awareness had been building up over time, but at this point where Jesus said, "Who do you say I am?" he just blurted it out. He knew what the answer was. Now, I grant you, it's not always like that when God speaks. Sometimes God speaks through a long and careful process of searching the scriptures and praying to him, listening to the whispers of his spirit in our inner ear. Now, that's a different way for God to speak. And God does speak in different and many ways. But here's an example of when it seemed obvious to Peter. It seemed clear to him. And he didn't need to consider it or think it through. In fact, I think if he had sat down and reconsidered and had second thoughts, he might have blown it and got it wrong, I think. As the questionnaires say, just put down the first answer that comes to you. And Peter got it right in one. Notice, by the way, verse 18. Jesus says, "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it." Not only did Jesus say Peter's right, but he said this will be the foundation of the church. The name Peter means rock. Jesus gave him that name. Now, Jesus could mean that Peter, this man, will be the foundation of the church, the leader, the Bishop of Rome, the first Pope, and so on. Or he could mean, perhaps, that the church will be built on direct revelation from God the Father. Or he could mean that it will be built on the confession of Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. That seems the most likely to me. Paul talks to Timothy about making the good confession. Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem, was built on a rock. The wise man built his house upon a rock. And now Jesus is building God's new temple, the church, the people of faith, the community of disciples, building it on the rock of Peter and his confession of Jesus as the Christ. And even today, this is still the most crucial question. It may not seem important when you read the newspapers and so on. You read about all the other questions that people are asking. Who's going to win the World Cup? Who might win the next election? What will the weather be like tomorrow? But actually, Jesus puts all that into the shade. The biggest question in life is how we respond to him, to Jesus. He starts with the vox pop question to his disciples about society. Who do people say the Son of Man is? He avoids saying the key words, "I am," to begin with. He calls himself the Son of Man, the figure from the book of Daniel who approached God's throne. But they knew he was talking about himself. And they give a range of answers from the street, if you like, about Jesus. The crowds chatter, the rumours being bandied about. Some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, some say Jeremiah. But you, he pins them down. Who do you say I am? People sometimes today say, "Oh, he's a good prophet. Oh, he's a good teacher." Maybe even a storytale figure like Father Christmas or the Tooth Fairy. Actually, I think we can ask people, can't we? Why not? Go out and ask your neighbours. Go out and ask folk who aren't Christians. Who do you think Jesus is? Who do you say he is? I think today we might get some very interesting answers, actually, because people don't know much about Jesus. They come up increasingly with rather random answers. But what about you, says Jesus? Who do you say I am? And he puts them on the spot. Because once you've realised who he really is, then everything changes. His significance is clear. The importance of the question is clear. Because the choice to accept him or to reject him is right in front of you, at your feet. And you can't move forward or back without answering that question. Will I worship him and follow him, my Lord and my God? Or will I turn away and reject him? In a moment, I'm going to ask us to follow Simon Peter's words and to say that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, you may not be quite ready to say that yet, to agree with that. And that's okay. You may need a little bit more time to think and to examine the claim and to read the stories in the Gospels. But if you are ready, there's no better time, there's no better place than to say it today and here. To say it with Simon Peter, if you like. So what I'm going to ask us to do is just pause for a moment while those words remain on the screen. Just pause and think about the significance of those words, of confessing Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God. Let's think about that in quiet for a moment. Now, would you all please stand? And if you'd like to do that with me, if you're ready to do that, then please would you respond with the words on the screen. What about you? Who do you say I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God.